All right, I've got 9:31. We're going to jump in. Your homework for last week was Perpetua. Give me some thoughts. What did you think of the reading? Any of it? Okay, not as gory as you thought. Yeah. Yeah, they're, Perpetua was a Montanist, which we talked about a few weeks ago about how they were like almost charismatic Pentecostal sect of the church, and so her visions were very much like a characteristic of Montanists. Other questions, other thoughts? Cool. Oh, yeah.
Put in his blood, gave it back.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you get one of these? You're good. I'll bring it to you. All right, so this morning we are hitting a very major change in church history. For the first 300 years of the church, Christians were, and as we've seen and saw last week especially, Christians were the targets of persecution. And things begin changing towards the end of the 3rd century with some things in Rome. And so we're going to have the map so you can see it. I'm a visual learner. I need to see it on a map to kind of put it in perspective. And so hopefully this will be helpful. So in the year, about in the 280s. So the red is, so the borders are modern day borders. So these are the countries as we have them today. And the red is the Roman Empire and the expanse of it. And so you've got in this, you've got Rome about right here, and where Caesar and his leadership resides over this massive empire. It's humongous. And in the late 200s, you start getting some issues where you've got Germanic tribes invading from here. You've got Persians invading from here. And the Roman Empire starts to lose a little bit of control, especially at its borders. And so you've got a guy named Diocletian, who is a soldier who rises through the ranks and eventually becomes Caesar in the year 284. And he starts making some drastic changes across the Roman Empire because he believes they will be for the good of the Roman culture, but also and especially good for their control of their borders. Diocletian sees the struggles with one man leading this entire faith from here, and he decides to change things up. And so he divides the empire. And he divides it here, and here, and here, and here. And so what he divides it into four corners, essentially. And he says, we don't need one Caesar ruling from the middle of this. We need two Caesars. And he divides it between the east and the west. So Diocletian rules over here. And Maximinus rules over here. And so what we have is then you have Diocletian ruling the east, Maximinus ruling the west. But it's still too big, so they need number twos, each of them. And so Maximinus gets Constantius. And Galerius for Diocletian. And so Galerius is Diocletian's number two. Constantius is Maximinus's number two. And to distinguish so that no one got confused, Diocletian and Maximinus were called Augustus, and Constantius and Galerius were called Caesar. And so you have two Augustuses and two Caesars ruling over the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire becomes a tetrarchy, ruled by four. All of this strategy allowed the Roman Empire, allowed them to have leadership, solid, firm, military-minded leadership, stationed throughout the empire. It allowed the Caesars and the Augustuses to rule and only be concerned about their area rather than one guy in Rome ruling, worrying about the whole thing. Then we get this aspect of being able to better defend their borders from attack, being able to have better military control within their borders and keep the peace. And all of this, really, I look at this and I go, what a great, wise move. But in reality, historians look at this and go, this shows you how far Rome is falling and how quickly they're losing their grip. The one of the things, the most amazing feat about the Roman Empire is that they were able to rule an area this vast and expansive with one ruler for 1,000 years and never had any revolts because they squashed it instantly. And now you've got outsiders attacking, revolts coming up from within, and in order to maintain control, they've got to split power four ways. Yes.
Every second sentence he talks about how proud he used to be a Roman citizen.
Right.
And that deteriorated. It was this basis of, I'm proud to be a Roman, so I'm going to help defend it. And that's what made it work.
Yeah.
Yeah,
citizenship becomes less and less valuable. And it used to be where if you were a Roman citizen, that was the single greatest component of who you were. That was your identity. That drops off. And Roman citizens no longer really care that much about being Roman citizens because it doesn't really garner them that much support or protection or benefits that others no longer have. So let's, questions about how the empire divided. Yeah.
I read that before those killings of the two ladies we just mm-hmm. heard about, there was a civil war. Is that what?
Yeah, so Rome had lots of civil wars. So one of the reasons that Diocletian ends up coming to power is because there's a civil war, and he actually puts it to bed and says, we're done with this, leads Rome into victory over it, and then the people are so thrilled and so excited to have this great war hero, they say, you should be Caesar. And so he sort of rises up, which always makes for a great, great model when you're fighting a civil war and you appoint your great military general to be your next president. Turns out really well. It leads to a very peaceful society. Right. So we have this divide, and it doesn't quite divide eventually, and not long from where we are. The Roman Empire is going to split, and you're going to split about along this line into an East and a West Empire. The West Empire is going to fall. Rome's going to be burned. It's going to come crashing down. The East is going to stand for another 1,000 years. It stays alive and stays thriving. But the West ends up falling horribly. So let's talk about the East with Diocletian and Galerius. Diocletian his attitude toward Christians is mostly tolerant. He's not hunting them down. He's not trying to arrest them. He's not overtly persecuting them. Primarily because his wife and his daughter are both Christians. But Diocletian is not, and he is highly suspicious of them. Because, as we talked about last week, or a couple weeks ago with the writings of Tertullian and others, the church believed and argued that Christians could not serve in the Roman military. Primarily because Roman soldiers had to bow down to Caesar. It wasn't just a serve your country, patriotic thing. It was, if you're a soldier, you are worshiping and leading and serving underneath your God, who is Caesar. And Christians couldn't do that. And so they couldn't serve in the army. Which makes Diocletian, our military war general, very suspicious of Christians. Why wouldn't you serve in the military? Why wouldn't you serve and work and protect? And so he's very suspicious. So, tolerant, but suspicious. Galerius is a different matter altogether. Galerius was much more hostile towards Christians, but because he's the number two, he submits to Diocletian. He doesn't step out of his way. He doesn't go above and beyond. He just says, this is Dio's show. I'm going to step in line and just follow his example, at least for the time being. So toward the end of Diocletian's reign, he switches gears, and his tolerance now becomes hostility. he issues four edicts that only apply to the east. They only apply east of here. But his four edicts are these. All church buildings are to be destroyed. All Bibles are to be burnt. And all Christian worship forbidden. Edict number two. All clergy are to be arrested and tortured. So Diocletian's perspective, he's learned over the years. He has studied this Christian movement. He's studied the martyrs. And he's seen what martyrdom has done to the church. And so Diocletian says, the problem is we don't need to kill Christians. We need to make it painful enough that they no longer want to be Christians. When we kill them, we set an example. And people want to follow that example. But if we torture them, then there's no martyrdom. There's no celebration. There's just pain and suffering. And so Diocletian said, he arrested all pastors, all bishops, all elders, and tortured them. All clergy, his third edict, in the midst of this arresting and imprisonment and torturing, he required that the only way out of this imprisonment and torture was for those clergy to make a sacrifice to the gods. You want this to stop? You want this to end? You want the pain to cease? I'm not going to kill you. I'm going to let you out, but only if you offer a sacrifice to the gods. And then his fourth edict. So those three edicts were all issued at the same time. About a year later, he gives a fourth edict where he says all citizens throughout the empire, east and west, must offer a sacrifice to the gods and be executed if they refused. So this is not simply, it's not an attack towards Christians explicitly, but he's saying every single citizen in the Roman Empire is required to offer a sacrifice to the gods, and if you don't, you'll be executed. Diocletian gets very sick in 305, and he steps down from power. So he doesn't die in the office, he steps down and pulls back, leaving Galerius to become the new Augustus. And so Galerius, the one that's always been hostile to Christians, now steps in and takes power. Galerius promises death to every Christian in the empire, regardless of how much it would cost Rome to do it. He says, so Diocletian said it's not financially prosperous. You've got Christians that are approaching half of the population now. It doesn't make sense to spend all this time, all this money, all this effort to kill Christians. Galerius says, I don't care if it bankrupts the empire. I'm killing them all. And so he starts hunting them down. A few years later, so that happens 305, 306. In 311, so 6, 7 years later, Galerius gets sick. You that have been deathly sick before know that things change when you're laying in that bed. It's no different for Galerius. Galerius gets deathly sick, and he issues an order that goes across the east, and he says, stop killing Christians. We're done persecuting Christians. In fact, Christians, if you're out there, I need prayer. Will you pray for me? And so Galerius asks Christians to pray for him. Galerius eventually dies from the sickness, leaving Licinius and Maximinus Daya in control of the east. So you've got Licinius is here. And Maximinus Daya. So there's lots of Maxes here. So, Licinius is actually the Augustus. Maximinus is the Caesar. So that's a brief history of the East. Let's look at the West. In the West, you have Maximian. I'll spell that one back out so you have it. And Constantius. Any guesses on who Constantius is? Or who comes from Constantius? Constantine. So Constantius is actually the father of Constantine. So again, we divide the West into Caesar and Augustus. The Augustus is Maximian. He is very angry and hostile towards Christians. He persecutes very harshly this entire area, kills many of the church leaders in Carthage and in North Africa. He's angry and violent. Constantius is different, and he sets himself apart from all the other leaders of Rome. Constantius is mostly tolerant of Christians, and not even just tolerant, but bordering on protective. Even though Diocletian had ordered in his edicts that all church buildings are to be destroyed and all clergy are to be arrested and tortured and all this stuff, Constantius never kills a single Christian. He burns down just a few churches just to appease Diocletian, but he allows Christians to continue to meet in his area. When Diocletian steps down because he gets sick in 305, he actually requires Maximian to also step down. And he says, if I've got to go, you're coming with me. And so Maximian has to step down, which then leaves him out, and Constantius becomes the new Augustus of the West. When Constantius dies in 306, so about a year or two after Diocletian steps down, Constantius reigns for just a year or two. He dies in 306, and his soldiers are so loyal to him and so supportive of him that they decide of their own volition that the next person to replace him doesn't need to be some other Augustus and Caesar, but it needs to be his son, Constantine. And so his soldiers elect and appoint Constantine in the British town of York, and he becomes the new Caesar in the West. Tensions in the West remain high. You have this. So Maximian is gone with Dio. In his replace is Maxentius. Super confusing. I really just wanted to say Max and Max and Max, but that would lead everybody down a dark hole. So Constantine is now here. Maxentius is his superior. He's the Augustus. Constantine's the Caesar. And tensions between the two of them stay high. They don't agree. They don't see eye to eye. They're very tense across one another. And it breaks out in a war in 312. And so in this war, just looking at a purely territorial perspective, population perspective, Maxentius has the upper hand. He has more people. He is the bigger army. He has Rome. He has everything in his power to wipe out this little northern group of rebels. But he can't, because Constantine is a great general, and he's a great leader. And he actually leads his army all the way down into Rome. And he takes over Rome. There's this final battle right outside the city. The two armies are staring at each other across the Tiber River. And in between is the Milvian Bridge. And so they're standing there staring at each other, getting ready for the next day where it's going to be the final showdown. This is going to be the battle that decides the war. And up to this point in Constantine's life, he is a sun worshiper. He worships Apollo, for lack of a better word. He's a sun worshiper. But the night before the battle of Milvian Bridge, Constantine gets a dream. And in this dream, he looks up and he sees the first two letters of the Greek word for Christ, the chi and the rho, they are in the shape of a cross. And so what we get is two options, what historians have said. Either it was this, or it was this. So the chi is the X, the rho is the P-looking thing, and essentially, in his dream, he gets this symbol appear before him, and a voice calling from heaven that says, "By this sign, you shall conquer." So Constantine wakes up from his dream and says, clearly, what I need to do is to use this sign on in my army. And so he takes this sign and he has his soldiers paint it on all of their shields and on all of their helmets. He paints it all over his soldiers. He prays in that morning before the battle, he prays to the Christian God for victory. And he wins this amazing, crushing, overwhelming victory, where with even Maxentius being killed in battle. And so at the age of 32, Constantine becomes the sole ruler of the Western Roman Empire. There's no one else. There's no Caesars. There's no number twos. He's it. And he has now taken over all of this. It's his. He's 32 years old. He believed After taking over Rome and establishing his seat of power there, Constantine believes firmly that it was the Christian God who gave him the victory. And from that day forward, Constantine becomes the champion and the protector of Christians across the empire. So, Constantine is now the ruler here. This is his empire. Maximinian Sia doesn't really work out. Licinius becomes the bigwig of the West. Constantine and Licinius don't see eye to eye. It's amazing how a military-minded people has a hard time getting along with other rulers. But he doesn't. Constantine and Licinius are throat-to-throat, at each other's throats for a long time. They think that they find a peaceful agreement in that Licinius marries Constantine's daughter. And so they reach this agreement that we're not going to fight because here's marriage to solve everything. And in this agreement, in 323, they come to agree and let out a very famous and well-known edict of their own, the Edict of Milan. And the Edict of Milan is important for a number of reasons, but the primary reason that the Edict of Milan is important is because it is the first time that the Roman Empire legalized Christianity. The Edict of Milan stated that Christians were no longer second-class citizens. They were no longer to be targets of the Roman Empire. They were now protected by Romans. All church property that had been taken and stolen and repossessed by the government is now being restored to the churches. And it effectively ends persecution from the empire. Roman Empire will never again persecute Christians. Now the two emperors, even though they reach this agreement, marriage takes place, they put out this Edict of Milan together, tensions never resolve. And so the two emperors continue to struggle, they continue to fight over the next year, before Constantine ultimately defeats Licinius in battle, and he becomes the sole emperor of the entire Roman Empire. And that is in 324. So now it's Constantine's show. There's no tetrarchy, there's no splitting of the East and West, all of this is Constantine's. And Constantine's empire is... I read one book that said, apart from the Apostle Paul's conversion, Constantine's conversion is the single greatest conversion in Christian church history. It had the widest ranging impact. It had the greatest effect of the church and of the ministry of the church. That apart from the Apostle Paul, Constantine is number two as the greatest conversion, the most important conversion in Christian history. No, this is still, he becomes, in 312 is where he becomes the, where he defeats Maxentius at the age of 32. And it's 12 years later that he becomes. So he is 44. Thank you. Constantine does some really great things for Christians in his reign. But he also does some things that raises a lot of questions. So let's talk about some good things he did. First thing he does is he rebuilds church buildings. All the buildings that Diocletian and others had burned down, Constantine uses Roman tax dollars to rebuild them. Second great thing he does is that he is the first national leader to make clergy exempt from paying taxes. Constantine says, if you're a pastor, if you're a bishop, if you're an elder, you don't have to pay taxes to the Romans. Three, he legally recognized Christianity in the Edict of Milan. And in the year 321, he declared the first day of every week to be a national holiday. Right? We still feel some of the impact of that, or at least have in years past. But Constantine's the first guy to say Sunday is a day off for the entire nation. But the problem is, he took that first day of the week and he named it Sunday after the sun god, Apollo. And so there's some questions here about what Constantine really believed and how he sort of merged his belief together. And many scholars look at the way that he acted and some of the things that he said and said basically because he was previously a sun worshiper who converted to Christianity, what he did was he took Apollo and Yahweh and combined them together. And so in his mind, he's worshiping the same god. It's just a little bit different now. So let's talk about some questionable things that Constantine did. And really, they're not so questionable. Constantine, throughout his reign, still cultivated very strong ties with pagan religion.
The first coins that he published and had minted as emperor had pagan gods on them. You would think that if you were a converted Christian and believed the gospel, the first thing you would do is remove idolatry. Constantine doesn't do that. He mints the first coins he mints have pagan gods on them. He maintains the pagan title that was given to all the Caesars of Pontifex Maximus, the high priest of the pagan religion. He holds on to that title and has people refer to him that. Constantine, while claiming to be a Christian, was not baptized until his deathbed. Now, that raises a lot of questions for me, but when we look at the history, this is more common than we think. We've talked in the last couple of weeks, especially about how there were certain sects of the church that believed that any sins committed after baptism could not be forgiven. And so it becomes common practice for someone to convert to Christianity and say, there's no way I'm making it to my deathbed without sinning. I'm going to wait to the very last moment I can until I get baptized. Then I don't have to worry about it. And so Constantine does this. He's not baptized until his deathbed. And that sort of is a common practice at the time. Now, most of what we know about Constantine was written by Eusebius of Caesarea. You read him the first week. Eusebius was a very close friend of Constantine. He was part of his inner circle for much of his reign. And Eusebius, being a Christian, as he wrote this biography about Constantine. And so almost everything we know about Constantine comes from Eusebius. However, Eusebius, because Constantine was his close friend, Eusebius wanted to write and to paint Constantine in as positive a light as he possibly could. And so he sort of washes over a lot of the events that other historians have pointed to and said, this happened. Eusebius doesn't mention that. There are times and events in Constantine's life that lead to questions about the legitimacy of his faith, whether he was a true Christian or not. Now, positively, Constantine was a strong leader. He had a commanding presence. He was very tall, very strong, very handsome man. And he had a physical presence that always carried a positive impact on those around him. People loved the guy. He was easy to follow. He had a sharp insight into people's character and motives. If someone does something or works for something, he is very quick to say, I know why you did that. I know what you're trying to do here. And so he's very, very wise, has just great perception of the people around him. He's very generous with his money. He is a just and fair ruler. And he, by all accounts, Eusebius includes this, as well as every other historian who accounts for this, Constantine was had this remarkable purity in all matters of sex, which is unheard of, especially for the Roman leaders. Constantine set the example and led the way in what this looked like. So that's the positive aspects of his leadership. Negatively, Constantine was very vain and very flashy about his personal appearance. He wanted to look good always. He was an easy prey to flattery. If you praise Constantine for the way he looked or the way he led or a decision he made, get that guy in here. Let's hear more from him. And then as his power increases, because it increases quite a bit, as his power increases, Constantine becomes more and more tyrannical with his leadership. You don't question his decisions. You don't come back with it. You don't raise your eyebrows. You don't do anything. Constantine's the leader, not you. And so he becomes increasingly suspicious about the loyalty of his relatives and friends and the people closest to him. Are they really loyal to me? Or are they just afraid of me? Are they really doing this to serve me and to serve the empire? Or are they trying to get behind me so they can stab me in the back? There's one terrible example where Crispus, Constantine's son, Constantine has a son through one woman, then remarries a woman named Fausta, and Fausta falsely accuses Crispus of trying to rape her. And he says, she comes to Constantine and says, that son of yours, my stepson, tried to attack me. He tried to assault me. Constantine orders Crispus to be executed on the spot. Doesn't allow Crispus to even give an answer to the accusation. No trial, no justice, just immediate death. Because his wife accused. And that was all Constantine needed. So Constantine has, again, still hold to the fact that it's the most important conversion behind the Apostle Paul, but there's questions about whether that conversion was legitimate. Constantine's impact on the church was far-reaching. And again, both positively and negatively. See, before Constantine, the church had already begun to formalize its leadership structure. You have this period of time where, especially in the early church, in the years following Acts, in that first century, prophecy becomes a very central component of church worship. Where it is very much has anybody heard from the Lord? Does anyone have a word from the Lord to share with the church today? That is a central piece of early church worship. But as the Bible becomes more canonized, and we'll talk about that in just a second, but as the New Testament becomes recognized and spread around the churches across the world, the need for prophecy becomes diminished. We no longer need a word from the Lord from a prophet. We now have the word from the Lord in the scriptures. And so there's no real formal process of how they moved and how they accepted and said, these are the books of the New Testament. But there were some criteria that we know from historians and from writers of the time what they were looking for before adopting a book into the canon of Scripture. So these are the three criteria. It had to be apostolic. The book had to be apostolic, meaning that only books that were written either by the apostles or by their associates, like Luke and Mark, only those books could even be considered. Which is important, but it also creates problems. Because you have the Gospel of Thomas, who was an apostle, and it was a very Gnostic gospel. And so you can't just leave this criteria on its own. We'll come back to the Gospel of Thomas, because it wasn't actually written by Thomas. But that's why they claimed it was written by Thomas. To give this credibility, because it's apostolic. Second criteria is, it has to be Catholic. Not Roman Catholic, but Catholic as in universal. This book has to be accepted by most churches in most places as true and biblical. And then the last one, it has to be Orthodox. Only books that accurately reflected and are consistent with what they knew about the Old Testament were accepted. So if a book like the Gospel of Thomas goes way out into left field with its teaching and theology, they can say, well, yeah, even if it is written by the Apostle Thomas, and even if it is accepted by many Christians, this thing is so far away from Orthodox teaching, it can't be Scripture. So those three criteria sort of shaped and guided what books were accepted as the New Testament. So with that, you no longer have the need for prophets in the church, because now you have the Scriptures. Additionally, you have bishops becoming sort of rising to even having greater influence over larger areas. Bishops become more prominent leaders of these large areas of churches. Bishops lead areas. Elders lead churches. And so as bishops sort of assume more authority, certain bishops become more important based on the areas in which they lead. So the Bishop of Rome has more power, more authority for the church than the Bishop of Mount Pleasant. Like it's you're comparing apples and oranges here. And so the Bishop of Rome, the bishops of Antioch, the bishops of Carthage and Alexandria become the most important bishops for the church. And they each claimed a tie to their position that an apostle, one of the apostles, served in this role as the bishop of this city, of this area, of this church. And what you get is this type of monarchical episcopate where it's the bishops sort of become almost like kings. They make decisions for the church. They make and they're kings of their little areas of churches. But the decisions and the theology and the teachings they give are then handed down as almost like kingly decrees. And it becomes the church, this leadership structure of the church becomes to mirror and become very close to the Roman political leadership structure. And what you have happening here at the time of Constantine is this the church, which has long been persecuted, long been cast out, long been in hiding from the Romans, are now, because they're being accepted, are now bringing secular Roman ideals into their church leadership structure and are merging the two. And so the church starts to become less focused on theology and more focused on strategy. Not what do we believe, but how do we continue our influence? How do we continue our reach? How do we continue to grow? And see, after the Edict of Milan and Constantine rise to power, the church has, for the very first time, a real cultural influence on the people around them. The cities in which the churches live and exist and move are now being persuaded and convinced and turned to for advice on issues of the town. And so with this cultural influence, churches now are prospering. Not just numerically, but also financially and materially. Because no one's coming in and burning down their church building every 2 years. And so they're able to start growing and prospering. Christianity under Constantine moves from persecuted to exalted and favored. And we'll see this next week. But Constantine, for all of the things that he does well for Christianity, he actually begins to insert himself into church debates. And he begins, we'll look at the Arian controversy next week. But the Arian controversy is resolved and dealt with at the Council of Nicaea, which should be a church council. This should be a gathering of bishops and a gathering of pastors and a gathering of Christians to debate and discuss this theological issue. But you know who sits at the head of the table at the Council of Nicaea? Constantine. And so over the next several emperors, with one exception being Julian the Apostate, over the next several emperors for Rome are all Christians. And over the next several emperors, the church and the state begin to work more closely together on all things and all matters. The church is, the state is involving itself in church matters, and the church begins involving itself in state matters. And what you have is a theology that sort of develops and blends the two together. And the church and state sort of come to this agreement, and they begin to see themselves as the right and the left hands of God. What problems arise with this? The easy answer is all of them. All of the problems arise from this. Do you have any examples that you can think of? What's the problem with the church and state becoming so intertwined like this? Power. Because what you eventually have happening is these, you have church leaders and state leaders now competing for authority over each other. Because the question that begins to be asked is the state over the church as the government? Or is the church over the state because Jesus is Lord over all? And this blurring of the lines between church and state continues and becomes the greatest cultural factor and the greatest church issue of the entire Middle Ages. It is not until the 1700s that significant Christians begin to argue that the church and the state should have nothing to do with each other. Questions? Yeah.
He told us right there.
Yes. Give to Caesar what is Caesar and to God what is God's. I mean, this becomes a huge issue. Like, oh, I'm thankful for Constantine, because under Constantine and the Edict of Milan, where he legalizes Christianity, the church no longer has to stay in hiding. And that's a good thing. When the church can worship publicly and freely without fear of being killed for it, the one thing that happens is more people begin considering the truths of the gospel. They're able to engage without fear of death or torture or imprisonment. But when the state becomes involved, then the state becomes involved not just in what the church can and can't do, but also what the church can and cannot believe. And we'll see that a little bit more with Constantine, or with the Arian controversy next week. All right, so for your homework this week, it's a two-parter. So you've got 2 weeks to do it. It's the longest homework that I've given you yet, so I'm giving you the longest amount of time. I want you to read Athanasius's On the Incarnation. It's about 60, 70 pages. So we're going to talk about Athanasius next week as we talk about the Arian controversy. Athanasius was a big leader of the church at the Council of Nicaea, and he wrote in favor of what the incarnation is, how Jesus became human, what that means, all of it. So it's an important book. If you read it all this week, you'll be more equipped for next week. If you read half of it this week, you'll have an easier time next week. But you've got 2 weeks to read Athanasius on the incarnation. Final questions, final thoughts?